This is the Cross Point Sermon Audio from Carrollton, Texas.
Great job, guys. Well, good morning. Welcome to Cross Point and Theater 166. My name is David Knight. I am the community curator around here. Our story shaper and lead pastor, David Walstead, is currently out of the country. He's in Uganda, working with our Uganda Children's Project, the missional partnership we have over there. He's helping kids get to school, pay for fees. He's also doing some leadership training with the Ugandans over there, as well as doing an evangelistic outreach. And I talked to him last night, and it sounds like things are going pretty well. Well, we are at the halfway point of our 31-week journey through the Bible in a series called The Story. The story is based on the book of the same name by Zondervan. It's a chronological ordering of the Bible. It doesn't contain all of the Bible, but it is designed to get you to see the Bible as one continuing story of God and His people. The whole idea is to get you to enter into the story and really connect with it. And I think sometimes that's a difficult thing to do. We have a lot of distractions in our lives, in our world, that keep us grounded to our 21st century lives. It's a hard thing to place ourselves in the shoes of a tribe of people that lived over 2,000 years ago. They have strange names and do odd things, and it takes a lot of imaginative power to try and picture what it means to live in their reality. And imagination is often frowned upon in the church. Let's face it, people equate the word imagination with delusion and make-believe, something we really don't want to put onto the Bible. Well, this morning I want you to see imagination as an extension of being created in God's image. As reflectors of the ultimate creator, as we have said time and again, we are thoughtful creatives or co-creators. And within that concept is certainly an element of imagination. And this morning, my job is as a preacher. It's been said that the work of a preaching is an art of imagination, an offer of an image through which perception, experience, and finally faith can be recognized in alternative ways. Good speech abounds with images, images that represent values, desires, fears, ambitions, and all other human emotions. And thus, we might actually define preaching as enabling persons through God's power to exchange old images for new. This week we celebrate the 50th anniversary of one of the most remarkable speeches ever delivered. On August 28, 1963, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. stood in front of over 200,000 people gathered at the Lincoln Memorial and declared, "I have a dream." Now, Dr. King understood that preaching, at its best, is a dream filled with images, and that the essence of a sermon is an appeal to the imagination, a call for people to envision a world different than the one they are in. Well, this morning, I want to appeal to your imagination. In order to craft my message, and indeed the entire structure of our gathering, I borrowed heavily from one of my favorite authors. But as I was reading his words, it struck me that they were astoundingly beautiful, brilliantly imaginative, and fit perfectly with where we are. And where are we? Well, today we find the Israelites in exile. We're going to focus in on the words of Israel's prophets during this period, particularly Isaiah. And as we do, I want you to try to keep in mind the things that Pastor Dave mentioned last week that Israel needed to learn while in exile. Things such as radical dependence on God, new depths of patience, the spaciousness of God, and a new perspective. With all that in mind, let's enter the story. The descendants of Solomon find themselves enslaved in Babylon. They once had the palace and the temple and slaves, the thriving economy and the massive military. They had wealth and influence and peace and blessing, but they lost it. They forgot their God, they neglected the widow and the refugee, and then exiled. In exile, however, they turned their pain into poetry. Psalm 137 puts it this way, "Beside the rivers of Babylon, we sat and wept as we thought of Jerusalem. We put away our harps, hanging them on the branches of the poplar trees. For our captors demanded a song from us. Our tormentors insisted on a joyful hymn. Sing us one of the songs of Jerusalem." But how can we sing the songs of the Lord while in a pagan land? They hung up their harps. The harp was an instrument of joy and celebration. You see, people played the harp because they had a reason to praise God. The harp was a sound you heard when life was good. Harps were played in the temple area when worshipers came to Jerusalem to honor God and give offerings. But the Israelites are not in Jerusalem anymore. They're in Babylon, where they hang up their harps. And they weep. In Babylon, they cry out. And what happens when people cry out? Well, in Egypt, the cry kickstarted redemption. In Egypt, they cried out in their slavery, and God heard their cry and did something about it. Because God always hears the cry of the oppressed. Crying out reminds us of our dependence. You see, when the system works for us, when we have the power and choice, when we're ruling from Jerusalem, when we have no needs to speak of, who needs to cry out? Weeping leads us to reconnect with God. And it didn't take long for these exiles sitting by the side of the river in Babylon to connect their agony with the story of their ancestors who were slaves in Egypt. You see, they knew that story. And now, here they are, back in the same kind of oppressive situation. But if God freed our people once before, couldn't God do it again? And so it's here, in exile, by the river, amid tears of despair, that God's people begin to dream again. Their repentance gives them a hope to see a future beyond the bitterness of all that they have lost. Maybe those harps don't have to hang there forever. Because it is when we are fully present in our pain, when we are willing to sit in our tears, that we can be ready to imagine a different kind of tomorrow. And that's what happened in exile. Prophets rose up in the midst of all the despair and hanging of harps and proclaimed not the end, but the beginning of something new. Something new for them. Something new for all of humanity. Something new for all of creation. The prophets of Israel came to the realization that what they needed was another exodus, a new exodus. The prophet Isaiah said that in this new exodus, they would soar on wings like eagles. And of course, wings of eagles is how God described the first exodus. And Isaiah says, it's going to happen again. The Lord will reach out his hand a second time to reclaim the remnant of his people. God is going to bring these exiles home, and not just them, but people from every corner of the earth. And God will do this because, as Isaiah says, he wants people to forget the former things. You see, God is doing a new thing. And what these people in exile realize is that the former thing, the first exodus, simply wasn't big enough. The first exodus was just a hint of the redemption God has in mind for all of humanity. Their ancestors had been set free only to find themselves in bondage again. The prophets concluded that the next exodus would have to be bigger, wider, deeper, and more enduring, more lasting than the first exodus. Otherwise, how did they know that their descendants won't repeat the same pattern? God had brought their ancestors out of the nation state of Egypt, but there is a far deeper, more insidious kind of Egypt, the kind that warps the heart, causes people to hurt and abuse and exploit each other. There is an Egypt we are all born into, and that is what we really need an exodus from. So when Isaiah speaks of this new exodus, he doesn't just speak of liberation from a particular oppressive empire. He speaks of liberation from anything that oppresses anybody, anywhere. God, he insists, will come and gather the people of all nations and languages, and they will come and see God's glory. So it's by the rivers of Babylon that the prophets began to imagine a God who is bigger than the narrow tribal religion of their Jewish heritage. But the prophets didn't stop there. You see, an exodus is a departure. It's a leaving, a movement. It's motion and energy and action. An exodus is something you do. It's something you're caught up in, somewhere you're going, something you join because you don't want to stay where you are. The prophets called it the way. Isaiah says, in the wilderness, prepare the way. Make straight in the desert a highway for our God. Wilderness, desert, images from the first exodus. Isaiah continues, all people will see it together. All people. Apparently anyone can join. Everybody is welcome to come home. Isaiah says, leave Babylon, flee from the Babylonians. Announce this with shouts of joy and proclaim it. Send it out to the ends of the earth. What we see in the prophet's predictions again and again is a movement from the particular to the universal. They start making promises to a specific ethnic group about their leaving a specific geographic location, but their expectations consistently expand until they're talking about all people. Now, the way wasn't a new idea. Their ancestors had spoken of how God provided a way for them out of Egypt, and that way had led them to a mountain called Sinai. Do you remember the if at Sinai? Because the Israelites did. God had promised that if they obeyed fully and were true and faithful, they would be a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. God also made it clear that if they were unfaithful to their vows, if they turned from God and forgot their story and followed other gods, there would be consequences. And before Moses had even returned from the mountain, these wandering former slaves had become impatient and began worshiping a golden calf, breaking the first agreement to have no other gods. So if Sinai was a marriage of sorts, it never really made it much past the ceremony. As these exiles began to dream of a new exodus, they came to the realization that their exile was the consequence of their nation's infidelity. And this realization brought them great hope. They concluded that if there was a penalty for failing to be priests in a holy nation, and they were paying that penalty with their suffering in Babylon, then at some point, they would be done paying the penalty. Their suffering would have to come to an end. They would have done their time, and their debt would be paid. So by the rivers of Babylon, the prophets began to reimagine grace. They started to see what it would look like for Israel's debt of sins to be paid, and what they saw was a reconciling grace, so big, so universal, that it could bind all human beings into a brand new way for the divine and the human to relate. But the prophets didn't stop there. You see, if Sinai was supposed to have been a sort of marriage, and that marriage didn't work out, then there would need to be some sort of a new marriage between the divine and the human. A new marriage, which would actually be a remarriage. Isaiah puts it like this: your husband, the Lord, will call you back. And so we return to Sinai, because the wedding centered around a covenant, a way for God and these people to relate to each other. And the first covenant revealed just how unfaithful people can truly be. So when the prophets spoke of this remarriage, they insisted that something fundamental in the way people related to God would have to change. The truth would have to be so deeply etched into the people's consciousness that they would naturally do the right thing. New Exodus people, remarried to God, leaving exile, headed home. Home to Jerusalem. A new Jerusalem. You see, the old Jerusalem had been known for the temple that Solomon had built there. And this wasn't lost on the prophets. They promised that even the temple would be transformed in this new reality. Isaiah says that there will be a temple big enough for the whole world to worship in. A new exodus, a new way, a new marriage with a new covenant, a new city, a new temple. What more could there be? Love. Isaiah tells us, the Lord will make himself known to the Egyptians, and in that day they will acknowledge the Lord. Egypt, according to their ancestors, was the enemy, the oppressor. So imagine Isaiah's first audience wrestling with this promise. Our worst enemy will become our brothers and sisters in peace. Isaiah continues, in that day there will be a highway from Egypt to Assyria. The Assyrians will go to Egypt, the Egyptians to Assyria. The Egyptians and the Assyrians will worship together. Assyria was another of Israel's worst enemies. Assyria and Egypt formed an axis of evil for Isaiah's people. And here he's promising that these two nations will have peace with each other, and their bond will be the worship of God. And continuing to preach the word of the Lord, Isaiah tells us that in that day, Israel will be the third, along with Egypt and Assyria, a blessing on the earth. Is God serious? They'll have peace between them? They'll get along? These nations hate each other. These are Israel's absolute worst enemies on the planet. And for Isaiah's listeners, Assyria and Egypt are the ultimate examples of evil. And Isaiah insists that someday they're all going to sit down together in a relationship of mutual respect and love and peace, bound by their worship of God. And Isaiah keeps going. He promises a salvation that reaches to the ends of the earth. He tells us God will create a new heavens and a new earth. Heavens, earth? Well, that's the language of Genesis. God's going to do that again? Bring order out of this chaos? The chaos that we know the world to be today? The former things didn't work. But the new thing will be different. Bigger, wider, ultimate. You see, for the prophets in exile by the rivers of Babylon, no vision was too large, no dream too big, no hope too beyond what would happen in the new Exodus.
This has been the Crosspoint Sermon Audio from Carrollton, Texas. For more information about our church, visit www.crosspoint.com.